Good afternoon and welcome, everyone. I'm Andrew Sobel, and with me today is my co-author for Power Relationships and also our last book, Power Questions, Jerry Panis. Welcome, Jerry.
Thank you. Good to be on.
People are still joining as we speak, but I think we should get started. Let me set the stage once again for our talk today. Today, we're presenting part two of the Building Power Relationships teleconference. I conducted part one on January 24th, and you should all have an email with the link to download the audio recording of that session. Jerry and I had decided, actually a couple of years ago, we were talking, we decided we just weren't going to write another book about building relationships. We had co-authored Power Questions together, and of course, each of us had written a number of books having to do with building deep relationships. Jerry, a number of bestsellers in the field of philanthropy, and in my case, books about client relationships. But the more Jerry and I thought about it, the more we realized there were, underneath everything we had written about, there were some underlying principles. We call them laws that have to guide our relationship building efforts. And we begin collecting them. And we put our heads together, we sorted through them, and we tried to then present in our latest book what we thought were the most powerful relationship building laws. And very briefly, for those of you who were not here in the first call, what do we mean by laws? Well, in the physical world, there are laws of gravity and laws of motion developed by Sir Isaac Newton, for example, that were identified by him that describe how things behave in the physical world. So we align our behavior with these laws of physics. When we climb a ladder, we're careful because we know we could easily fall off. Gravity will pull us to Earth. When we design an airplane, we do it with these laws of physics in mind so that it flies. And of course, when you go to bed at night, you probably don't worry that your furniture is going to move around unless there's an earthquake. And that's because, again, one of the laws of physics, which says that objects at rest won't move unless they're impacted by another force. So just as we align our behavior in the physical world with these laws, we want you to align yourselves with these relationship laws. I mentioned in the first teleconference that there are four main things that these laws help you to do. First, to connect with people. Second, to become relevant. Yeah, everyone's asking, why should I give you a half hour of my time? Well, the first teleconference focused on a group of laws to help you with those first two things, connect and become relevant. Now, today, Jerry and I are going to focus on the third and fourth challenges in relationship building. The third one is to resonate with the other person, to create a strong personal and emotional connection. And fourth, to make an impact in the relationship over the long term. So let's start out. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go through three or four of these laws, and then I'm going to turn it over to Jerry and actually do a bit of a question and answer with Jerry that I will lead. So let's look at some laws that will help you resonate and have an impact, that is, to make a really personal connection with the other individual that you're trying to build a relationship with. And I want to start with Law 16 from our book, which says, vulnerability is power. I'll explain more later, but we don't mean that you should be showing weakness and bewilderment all the time. That's not quite what we mean. It means you need to create emotional resonance. You need to connect on an emotional, not just an intellectual level. Now, the idea of being authentic seems like a very modern concept. Everybody talks about it now. But vulnerability is a way to build personal connections actually goes way, way back. And one famous example is Richard Nixon's so-called checker speech that he made in September 1952. He was the vice presidential candidate on the ticket with Eisenhower. And allegations have been made that he had used campaign funds in an illegal manner. And Eisenhower actually decided to dump Nixon from the ticket. And he sent him a message that he should resign. Well, that night, Nixon went on TV, and he made his case directly to the American people. To make a long story short, he gave a very folksy talk, and he basically said, I am going to tell you the whole truth here, and I want you, the American people, to decide whether I, Richard Nixon, should stay on the ticket or resign. He talked about his modest upbringing in Whittier, California, about working his way through college and so on. And then he said, the only gift we've ever received was a puppy, and we named him Checkers, and we're keeping that puppy. Well, after that speech, 4 million cards and letters and telegrams flowed in support of Nixon remaining as the VP candidate. In fact, that speech was pretty sincere, unlike, as we know, many of Richard Nixon's other performances later on. But that particular speech, apparently he did tell the truth. And the public sensed it, and they connected with him on a very emotional level. Now, it may seem hard to fathom, given what we know today, but it was a historic speech, and it probably changed the course of history, because Nixon's entire political career was on the line. Now, modern research by psychologists has shown that this emotional resonance, this vulnerability, creates relationship intimacy. Now, whether you're a man or a woman, this idea may make you uneasy, but don't get nervous. Again, as I said, emotional vulnerability is not exactly about showing people how weak you are. It involves sharing feelings and creating an emotional response with the other person. It means connecting on a very personal level. One study showed that when people, this is fascinating, when people made in the study a greater effort to be truthful each week for a number of weeks, and they told fewer lies, because, by the way, we all tell lies during the day, they reported that their close personal relationships had improved and their social interactions had gone more smoothly. Another study has shown, and I found this very interesting, that when someone is withholding the truth in some way, the other person's blood pressure rises. So how do you demonstrate emotional vulnerability in a healthy way? Well, look, here are some examples. Don't be afraid to say you're sorry or admit you were wrong. Empathize openly with other people. Talk about how you feel, not just think, about an important issue. Ask people for advice, which shows some vulnerability. Use humor. Joke about yourself. Admit to a shortcoming. Discuss an issue that's vexing or challenging to you. Share, obviously appropriately, the personal side of your life. And ask questions, finally. Ask questions that touch on the emotional aspects of the situation, not just the rational aspects. Here's a very simple example. I could say to someone, so what are your priorities this year? Or I could say, of all the things you're doing this year, what are you most excited about? What are you most passionate about? So if you ask the right kinds of questions, you can access this more emotional side. The next law that will help you resonate with others is law number 24. Enthusiasm is contagious. How do you react to people? Let me ask you a question. How do you react to people who never emote? Worse, who appear bored with everything around them. People who never seem to show any excitement for life. People who are like Lucy in the Peanuts comic strip. You know, she's always finding fault, never seeing the positive side of things. Chances are these individuals pull you down and they basically consume your energy. And if you have an evening free, they're probably not your first choice for a night out. But what about people who are enthusiastic and passionate about what they do? There's something really magnetic about them. They draw others in and lift them up. They are aligned with Relationship Law 24, which is enthusiasm is contagious. Now, enthusiasm comes from a Greek word meaning having a god within you. Now, I mention this because Jerry Panis' family was Greek, and he's proud of his heritage. Jerry, is that correct?
It is correct.
You're back on the line. Good. Now, this does remind me a little bit of, some of you may remember that wonderful movie, My Big Fat Greek Wedding, and Gus Portokalos, I think, was the father. And by the way, that movie in around 2002 became the highest grossing romantic comedy in history. It cost $6 million to make, and it grossed $350 million. So there's the power of the Greek culture there, Jerry. But, you know, Gus is very proud of his Greek heritage, and he's always telling people that virtually every word in the English language has a Greek origin. And so he keeps challenging people to name a word, any word, and he'll give you the Greek origin. Now, lack of enthusiasm can overshadow and really diminish talent. And let me give you an example. Some of you may remember the very famous best-selling British pop group called Oasis, you know, the Gallagher brothers. They, when they arrived on the scene, they were anointed as the next Beatles. By the way, you do not want to be anointed as the next Beatles, because even if really, really good, you are going to fall flat in comparison. Well, during Oasis, they had been a big hit in England, and they, so these guys had a very bored, insolent kind of attitude towards the world and towards their audiences. Well, during their first U.S. tour, they appeared that way on stage. They were just insolent, bored. They never smiled. They totally flopped in the U.S., totally flopped. No one bought their records, and even their English fans later got tired of their blasé attitude. And contrast that with that sort of indefatigable energy that the Beatles, the real Beatles, exuded on stage when they performed, or the Rolling Stones, who are still exciting audiences, you know, in their 70s. So your own enthusiasm influences everyone around you. It attracts people to you. It makes people want to be in a relationship with you. Now, I recall that in Power Relationships, Jerry, you used the example of Manny Jackson, a very, very successful African-American business executive and philanthropist who played for the Harlem Globetrotters and then later actually bought the team. You know, so I'm actually curious what, you know, Jerry, Manny is actually like in person. You know, what's it like to be in the same room with him?
Manny sits out electric sparks. It is absolutely amazing. He was born in a boxcar and lived the first 8 years of his life in a boxcar with 12 other members of his family. And but he was determined to be successful. And when you're and he grew in a corporate life till he became executive vice president of one of the major corporations. But then he wanted to own something, and the Harlem Globetrotters were very important to him. So he wanted to play with them. He played. He was All-American at the University of Illinois in basketball. The first black, by the way, to play at the University of Illinois.
Oh, Jerry, someone just emailed me and said, asked if you could speak up a little. Your phone might be a little lower than mine.
Oh, sure.
Okay,
Manny
great.
Jackson was the first black to play at the University of Illinois. His great object in life was to become a Harlem Globetrotter. He played for a couple years and then decided he wanted to buy him. Well, here's this guy who was born in a boxcar, lived with 12 other members of the family in the boxcar, and he grew in stature. He became a millionaire, became a multimillionaire, has served on a number of corporate boards. But to be around him, he sets off sparks, and he loves being with high school seniors and college students, and he surrounds himself with these young men and women. They sit at his feet, and he talks with them, and talks about enthusiasm. He is so excited, he gets them excited. Enthusiasm, Andrew, is indeed contagious.
Yeah, wow. Well, you know, honestly, and I didn't tell you I was going to say this, but you know, one of my role models for enthusiasm actually is Jerry Panis. You know, while I'm complaining about getting stuck at LaGuardia for a few hours, Jerry, it's true.
I didn't hear that.
It's Jerry Panis. But, you know, I complain about getting stuck at LaGuardia for a few hours, and, you know, Jerry brushes off a three-day forced layover in Chicago due to weather like it was nothing. And, you know, Jerry, what I like about you is you're not just excited about everything you're doing. You're excited about everything the other person is doing that you're talking to, and genuinely so.
Oh, I think that's important. You bet.
I find it very, very uplifting. So you just think about it. When you're incredibly enthusiastic about your work and your life, that attitude lifts up the other people in the room. It draws them to you. And, you know, on the other side of the coin, honestly, if you're not truly excited about what you're doing, why would someone else get excited about working with you? You know, whether you're serving clients in a private sector role or in a philanthropic role in building volunteers and donors and so on. So I want to move on to yet another law.
Before you go ahead.
Andrew,
the other component that is so important and is contagious is energy.
Mm.
And when you exert energy, the other person feels it and they feed it back to you. And energy is something that that you can have. It's not inherent. You can develop it. Energy is so important for all of the folks who are listening in to bring energy into the relationship. It becomes very important.
Yeah. Thank you. So let me move on to another law that we have found creates a very strong emotional connection, and it's Law 12. It goes like this. Change the environment and you'll deepen the relationship. This applies, by the way, at work, and it applies at home. So let me give you an example. They did a study of couples who had been married for 20 years or more, and the tradition of date night, and some of you may have heard this expression. It's the idea that as a married couple, every week you go out to a restaurant, get away from the kids if you have kids, and kind of just the two of you talking. Well, this study took one group of married couples, and they did their date night each week at the restaurant or wherever they went each week. And the other group, they had them change the location and do different things every single week. So one week they went to the movies, one week to a museum, one week to a restaurant, another week they just took a walk, and so on. And what they found was that the second group that kept changing the environment of their, quote, date night reported greater feelings of intimacy and affection in their relationship. I think something powerful happens when you and the other person experience your relationship in a new environment. You talk about different things. You engage on a more personal level. You learn more about the other person. In the book, Power Relationships, we tell the story of a top Citigroup executive who's a client of mine who was on a trip abroad with a client of his, and terrorists attacked their hotel, and they spent the entire night fleeing the terrorists through the hotel and the alleyways behind it. They actually ended up spending the last 3 hours of the morning literally in a garbage bin covered in trash. Well, their relationship was indelibly changed as a result. All right, I'm not recommending that you spend the night in a garbage bin with a major donor or, you know, a major client or someone important you're trying to build a relationship with. You don't have to go through such an extreme crucible to see the positive effect. Something a lot tamer will suffice. So just I'll give you an example. You might bring someone, accompany someone to a conference in a city where neither of you live. You'll probably end up spending hours over dinner together. You'll get to know each other better. You'll talk about different things than you normally would. And the relationship will be intensified, deep and stretched. Spending more time with this person in their office would never have the same impact. By the way, and I've been on a number of boards of trustees, an offsite is great for achieving that purpose. To me, that's one of the great benefits, is how the personal relationships develop when you are in an offsite situation if you're on a board. By the way, changing the environment also deeply affects, I think, relationships with friends and family. My own family will never forget a 9-day river rafting trip we took in Utah years ago. It was, I got to tell you, it was arduous. There were mosquitoes the size of hummingbirds, scorpions, river snakes. The first night, our youngest, who was probably 7 years old, got sick in the tent, and my wife took her to the riverbank to wash her sleeping bag off, and a giant river snake floated up to the shore. Sizzling heat. But today, I have to tell you, we can't stop laughing about that trip together. It bonded us, you know, brought us closer. And it really created a great communal memory. So if you want to create a deeper personal connection, change the environment, and you will deepen the relationship. Now, I want to move to the area of impact, and we have several laws in the book that I'm going to mention as a segue into our discussion with Jerry that have to do with the fact that generosity transforms relationships. I don't care if it's a business relationship, if it's in a nonprofit setting, if it's just generosity transforms relationships. So I'm going to briefly mention a couple of these, starting with Law 21, which says a selfless motive creates powerful bonds. A selfless motive creates powerful bonds. And the point is this. If everything you do has a kind of mercenary purpose, you're going to get similarly mercenary cooperation. So, for example, there's a lot of literature on networking that talks about reciprocity. And everybody cites Cialdini's famous book on influence. It's called Influence, the Psychology of Persuasion. So he's an academic, but he wrote this classic book on influence many, many years ago, which a lot of people quote. And in that book, he talks about the power of reciprocity. And he one of the examples he cites is I think it has to do with Ethiopia and Mexico. And I guess many years ago in the 1930s, when there was an earthquake in Ethiopia or something, the Mexicans had helped out. And it was like 60 years later, you know, there was an earthquake in Mexico, and all of a sudden they got this aid package from Ethiopia. And people were saying, well, this is incredible. It's a much poorer country than ours. You know, why are they doing this? And it all went back to 60 years earlier when they had received aid. Now, it is true that built into our DNA is the idea of what's called reciprocal altruism, and that is actually what evolutionary psychologists call it, reciprocal altruism. But you can't do it, as I said, as a kind of mercenary. You see, when we sense there's a pure motive, a selfless motive, we trust the other person. And I think it was Maimonides, the 12th century Jewish scholar, who wrote about different levels of giving, and I think one of the highest levels was when you give anonymously, you have no idea where the money's going, and then the recipients have no idea where the money comes from. And that really, so you're doing it for heaven, for God, for a higher purpose. And that really gets to this idea of a selfless motive. Now, there's another law, which is law in our book, Law 14, which says there's always something, no matter how small, that you can do to help the people around you. And I want to pause on this story for a second. It seems like a very obvious statement, but I want to talk about someone. His name is Steve Pfeiffer, a very long-standing client of mine. And Steve, he's in the book, and I've written about him in other forms, so this is public. Steve recently stepped down as the chairman of a leading international law firm. And I'll be honest with you, his accomplishments are enough to make even the most successful person feel like an underachiever. He was a commander in the U.S. Naval Reserve, a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford with Bill Clinton, Yale Law School, chairman of the Board of Trustees at Wesleyan, law firm CEO, and on and on and on and on. Now, setting aside his professional success, I was always struck by two things about Steve. First, his powerful network that extends around the globe into the highest levels of boardrooms and politics, but also his endless generosity. And it turns out these are intimately connected. You know, I've heard him on the phone with powerful U.S. senators, you know, Senate committee leaders, and moments later watched him spend even more time chatting with an Amtrak porter about the Yankees, all with kind of equal ease and pleasure. So he has good relationship skills, but his powerful network, to some extent, was built based on Steve's willingness to always lend a hand to other people. He told me his role model was his own father, who was always lending a helping hand to people in need in his community in a small New Jersey town. And Steve summed it up for me in a few simple words. He said, "My father taught me that you should always be looking for ways to help the people around you. There's always something you can do, even if it's a very small thing. There's always someone who has a need." And he added, it was interesting, he said, "You know the story of the Good Samaritan? Well, it's preceded by a question," Steve told me, "where a lawyer, someone skilled in the law, a lawyer, asked Jesus a question. And he says, 'Who is my neighbor?' And most of you know the story. The story basically says everyone and anyone around you is your neighbor, anyone in need, even if you don't know them. And Steve said to me, you know, for my dad, it wasn't just a story. He lived that every day. And in fact, Steve hasn't not just built this powerful network that it goes around the globe into the highest echelons of power, but he's followed in his father's footsteps. And, you know, for years he's mentored a handful of young men from fatherless homes, helping them with their education. He helped a young girl from Sierra Leone get a visa and help bring her to the States to be treated for horrible damage that was done during a forced circumcision. He's on the board of directors of Project Hope, the NAACP, the Legal Defense and Educational Fund, and many other organizations. Now, Jerry, are you on the line?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, good, good. I saw your name had popped off. I just wanted to make sure.
Oh,
you
yeah.
know, at this point, what I'd like to do, especially since we're talking about the power of generosity to create extraordinary relationships, I want to turn to Jerry, and I have prepared some questions for you, Jerry.
Oh, good. Before you do, Andrew.
But I'll let you. Yeah, you can give whatever introduction you'd like. The floor is yours.
When you were talking, you said that all of us face lies daily. And what did you mean by that?
I'm sorry, all of us what?
I thought you said that all of us face lies every day.
Oh, we say lies. So they've done studies of this, and the average person, I'm not saying you do, and I would never do it, but
yeah.
everyone tells small lies every day. I mean, it could be, apparently they would track as a lie if someone said, hey, how you doing, Jerry? And you said, I'm great.
But
you had a sore throat and felt terrible or something like that. I think they would track that as a lie. But, you know, I think the study I read said it was something like 10 or 12 lies a day.
Ah, got it. You know what I thought, and I didn't think of it until this very moment, actually. But it would help define relationships, and I think we need to understand also some relationships are great, and some are horrible, and some drag you down, and it's so important that you try to avoid and spend less time on those bad relationships. But I was thinking, and you will not remember this probably, when was the first time that you and I met? And it was in Santa Fe, and you were on the board of the Santa Fe prep school.
That's right.
And I was interviewing people in the community and on that board who the headmaster said were people of stature and affluence and influence. And that was the first time we met. And when I sat down with you and we started talking, I thought, oh, my God, who is this guy? He is outstanding. And I decided then, and this is 15, 20 years ago, I decided then I've got to somehow keep track of this person and keep in contact. And every once in a while, let them know that I'm still around. And so I think building relationships is, in a sense, keeping in contact and intervening. Well, through the years, you and I did talk. We did get together. We even talked at one time about doing a book that would be involved in fundraising.
That's right. Yep.
Yeah. And then we got together on this book. So I think, and the respect I had for you from the very first meeting, and I think building a great relationship does depend on mutual respect. And if that doesn't exist, it would be very hard to build a good relationship. And then the other thing, and I was just making a note of it yesterday, signing one of our books. And on our nameplate, Andrew and I chose a quotation from William James. And the quotation is, the greatest joy in life is a relationship where you do not have to explain. And I thought, that is so important, because where a great relationship exists, you really don't have to explain. There is this bonding. affection, regard, respect. That all takes place, and there are things you just don't have to explain. Well, okay, on with
yeah, that's I couldn't agree with you more. And it's funny, I was thinking about that William James quote. Of course, William James was a famous 19th century psychologist and philosopher, a brother of Henry James, the famous novelist, you know, who wrote Portrait of a Lady and other books. I think that quote embodies that, as you said, that idea of respect and trust, that you just don't have to explain things. So I really like that. So let me walk you through a few questions I have about relationships. And let me just say right now, we're going to be, you know, to some extent, talking a little more about building relationships in the philanthropic realm. But any of you on the call who work in the private sector, who serve client relationships in a business setting, you know, don't leave the call, because these lessons that we're going to talk about, I think, are just absolutely as important and relevant for the private sector as they are for the nonprofit sector.
Andrew, in so many ways, they're exactly the same.
They're exactly the same, yeah. Well, you know, Peter Drucker, the great management thinker of the 20th century, a lot of his early material, he wrote about nonprofits, and later he said, but it's the same, you know, and so he really moved back and forth between the nonprofit and for-profit sector throughout his career. But look, my first question, Jerry, is this: important people that we want to reach are unbelievably busy these days, and they are assailed with requests. This is true in every sphere. So, you know, in your experience, how do you cut through the clutter? How do you access and connect with people who are leading such busy lives? You know, and, you know, for example, we've got a couple of relationship laws about that. One of them is make them curious, which I like. And the other is, and I think you was one of yours, be unafraid to ask. So any thoughts on that?
Oh, yeah. There's a man in Toronto called Robert Deleuze. And he is the most inaccessible person in Toronto. He is a whirling dervish. He works 14 hours a day. You can't get to see him. He owns Porter Airlines, which is the fastest growing airlines in North America. And he works day and night. We needed to see him. There was no one on our board or among our volunteers who knew him or felt that they had access to him. Some were just darn afraid to even call him. So the executive of the foundation decided we had to see Bob Deleuze. And John went to his office, and he said to Bob's assistant, "I'm here to see Mr. Deleuze." She said, "He is not available." John said, "Oh, I understand, and that's perfectly all right. I've brought a book with me, and I'll just wait until he is available." And John waited an hour, and the assistant kept looking out and seeing John was reading his book, and finally came out and said, "Mr. Deleuze will see you. Who are you again?" And they had a wonderful conversation. They clicked on the very first meeting. Again, respect on both counts. And Deleuze now is chairman of John's foundation and the campaign. I could give you case after case. In the situation, just last week, I was with the CEO of Exxon, and I was told that it would be very difficult to get an audience with him. And furthermore, he is so busy, he just doesn't see people unless it has something to do with the operation. I said, "Can't we try?" "Well, we can make the call, but it won't work. He won't have time." I was with him last week, and we had 2 full hours together. It was fascinating. So I would say to everyone, and this is not only for those in philanthropy, but those in corporate life, you won't know until you ask. And I give you permission. I give you license. Make the call. Work at it. Try to make a connection. And, Andrew, what is the law? They say you're only 7 steps away from getting to the person that you really need.
Oh yeah, I think it's six degrees of separation, which actually today now they're saying it's more like 2 or 3 degrees because of, you know, social media and the internet.
So don't take as a given that some of the people you want to see are too busy to connect. Some will love talking with you. Some have been waiting for you to make the call. We say for fundraisers, there is a world out there waiting for you to contact them. Mm-hmm. And your job is to make the contact, get out of the office, make the call, and you won't know unless you work at it. So everybody lives a very busy life these days, but we're still making as many calls and contacts as ever.
Yeah. Well, Jerry, after the call, could I talk to you about a few people I'd like you to help me get introduced to?
Because
you're obviously better at this than I am. So let me move to a sort of follow-up question, which is, you know, many times the influential individuals, you know, whether they're a captain of industry or from a very wealthy family, whatever, the people we're trying to build relationships with often live in very different worlds than we mortals do. You know, for example, you might be trying to connect with a very wealthy donor. I might be trying to connect in business with a CEO who earns $5 or $10 million a year and travels on a corporate jet. That's just a little bit more than I make. I just want you to know that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what suggestions do you have? Not only just to connect with that first meeting, which I think you've talked about very nicely, but how do you actually build an ongoing relationship with someone at that level?
Let me give you an example. I was talking with Sam Johnson, who is the son of the founder of Johnson Wax, and very wealthy. He has probably given $300 or $400 million to Cornell, and along with a lot of other causes. We were talking about one of the questions I asked him is, who is one of your most most favorite person? Who do you like meeting with? And he mentioned a person named David Dunlop. Anybody listening in who's in philanthropy will know the name David Dunlop. And I said, my gosh, tell me about David. And I know David very well. What makes him so special? And Mr. Johnson went on and on about David. I had the feeling David became the son he never had, and the difference in net worth, you know, is extraordinary. I think that net worth is not does not limit anyone in terms of making a relationship and making a connection. How you make that connection becomes important. Let me tell you about, I'm embarrassed to tell this story. Let me tell you about my meeting with Jacques Maison Rouge. Jacques Maison Rouge was CEO of Global IBM. And my first meeting with him, and I was a young man, you know how many years ago that must have been, and I'm with Jacques Maison Rouge. And after maybe 55, 60 minutes, he said to me, young man, we've spent a lot of time together. I now know a great deal about you. Do you realize you know nothing about me? And I thought, and what a lesson. And it's embarrassing for me to even mention that, but what a lesson. To develop a good relationship, and Andrew, it's one of our laws, your job is not to impress people with how important you are or to impress them with your wisdom. Your job is to listen and to probe. And it's the greatest compliment to a person to have you listen and ask.
Mm-hmm. Well said. Thank you. I've been in a few of those meetings myself, Jerry, where I talk for 45 minutes and learn nothing. In fact, just had one yesterday. No, just kidding. I think I was a lot younger also, but as you like to say, experience is the best teacher, but sometimes the tuition is very high.
Yeah.
which and, I always...
Along that line, Andrew, I think it's so important because I always thought communications was probably the most significant skill and characteristic of a really great salesperson, corporate executive, or fundraiser. It's not communications. I always thought it was sending. What is most important is receiving.
Hmm.
Listening becomes our most important trait and skill.
Yeah. Yeah.
And by the way, it's not inherent. It's a skill that can be learned.
Yeah. So, Jerry, in our book, you wrote the last chapter in the book. We saved the best for last, you know, the best wine to bring out at the end. Yeah. And it's called the ripple effect. And the law in that chapter says every act of generosity creates a ripple. So I want to ask you to tell us a little bit about this law and how it impacts relationships. But also, you know, is this kind of a philosophy or thinking that we can embed in the way we talk to, you know, a nonprofit, potential nonprofit donor or even a top business executive? It's this kind of this idea of legacy and how our actions today really can affect literally generations in the future. Because, you know, in business, unfortunately, as you know, we've become so short-term oriented, and a lot of people are making decisions not even quarter to quarter, but month to month. So talk a little bit about this law and the story behind it. Every act of generosity creates a ripple.
Yeah, but again, let me, and I'll tell the story, but let me make the bridge also to corporate life.
Mm.
And how many corporate CEOs or corporate supervisors or co-workers become the model for someone? And often the person doesn't even know that they're the model.
Mm.
But this creates, again, a ripple effect. If you transfer some of your characteristics to someone else, it becomes a ripple effect, and that person then creates a ripple effect. Well, I'm talking with Rich Goldblatt, and he is a ship owner in Newport News, Virginia, and he's working late at night. It got to be about 10:30 at night, and a warm spring night, but he kept working, and then, you know, he looks at his watch, he decides it's time to leave. He goes out to the parking lot. There are no lights on the parking lot, but he's walking toward his car, and he notices out of the corner of his eye, there's a person, a huge guy, and the guy's wearing an overcoat for some reason on a warm spring night. He can't figure it out, and there shouldn't be anybody in that parking lot at this hour. And there's no one else but Rich and this guy. Well, Rich starts walking very fast toward his car. The guy seems to be following him. Rich is frantic. He's thinking, I only have a few bucks in my watch, but the guy can have everything. This guy could tear me apart if he decided to. Rich is fumbling for the keys in his jacket. He can't find the darn keys. The guy's gaining on him. He finally finds the keys. The guy is very close to him now. Rich is working with his keys into the lock. He can't. Have you ever tried to get the keys in the lock? You can't. You're fumbling. Can't seem to get it. And Rich is working as fast as he can. He can't get them in the lock to open the door. The person now is right next to him. Rich can feel his breath on his neck. The guy leans over. He reaches for Rich's hand. Now let me back up. Rich is very generous. He has been giving millions away to his community. One of his largest generosities is to the school system. Rich feels that if you coach two second and third graders to read, it could help change the world. The love of reading, books and knowledge and knowing more. And so he gives $2 million a year to the school system so they can, in the worst part of town, take second and third graders and teach them to the love of reading. So this guy now is right next to Rich. He reaches for Rich's hand. He reaches for his hand, and he shakes his hand, and he says, "Mr. Goldblatt, I just wanted to thank you. You're teaching my second grader to read, and now he's teaching me to read." And think of the ripple effect of Rich's gifts and how that will create the kind of momentum. It could really change the world. Well, the book actually is filled with stories not unlike that. Half of them have to do with corporate life, which affects us in philanthropy. Half of them deal with philanthropy, which affects corporate life. And so the laws really are relevant, and I think everybody would benefit from that. Okay, what other questions?
Well, you know, we probably have we're getting right down towards the end here. Let me ask you, because we said we'd run about 50 minutes. This one it actually would be helpful to my business clients, Jerry, and a lot of my clients who are trying to build their networks and connect with top level executives ask me, should I get involved in community and nonprofit organizations as a way of networking and meeting top corporate executives?
Great question.
So I'm curious how you would respond to that, because it's obviously there's different kind of angles to that question.
Yeah. We have there are some young attorneys, young accountants, people in service business and corporate life who feel it is important to get connected with a nonprofit, because on those boards are some of the key people that will make that will call on them. I can't tell you how often an attorney has said, "Being on this board has meant so much to me because it has led me to new business, people contacting me. Otherwise, they'd never know me." Now, I would suggest that you don't join a board for the sake of gaining new clients. You've got to have passion for the organization. You've got to feel great about the organization. You have to be willing to be a roaring advocate and to give and to get. If you can bring advocacy, a willingness to give and get, then by all means, do join a board.
Mm.
By the way, Andrew, something that is interesting, there's just been some new research on this. People who serve on boards and work as volunteers with organizations, are you ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
Actually live longer. They live 7 years beyond the actuarial tables. And the theory in back of the research is that people who give of themselves are having fun, are enjoying life, and those who enjoy life live longer.
Wow. That's extraordinary.
Yeah. I would encourage your corporate people.
But I think your point's a good one. There needs to be a genuine passion and interest there. It can't be a purely kind of mercenary thing that you're doing. So
exactly.
That's good advice that I'm definitely going to pass on. Well, look, we're just at the end of our call, and so let me do a quick recap. So on today's call and the last call, which is available as a MP3 audio download, and all of you should have that email with the link. We covered a number of laws around connecting and becoming relevant. Today, we focused on some laws for basically resonating on a personal level, connecting personally, and also having an impact through generosity. And those laws were, I'll just quickly mention them, Law 16, Vulnerability is Power, Law 24, Enthusiasm is Contagious, Law 12, Change the environment and you'll deepen the relationship. And Law 26, which Jerry's been talking about, every act of generosity creates a ripple. As Jerry mentioned, we've had a beautiful bookplate printed that goes into the front page of a hardcover copy of Power Relationships with the quote from William James. And if you buy a copy, or if you have a copy, or if you buy 10 copies, whatever, email either of us, and we will send you a signed bookplate or signed bookplates. We'll mail them to you that you can put in the front of your book. And some of you emailed me after the first teleconference, and actually those book plates went out today, so you'll be getting them next week to slip into your books. And after this call, I will send everyone an email with the download information to get a recording of this session in case you missed it or if you'd like to listen to it again or share it with a friend. So thank you very much for joining us. Have a great weekend. Jerry, thank you as well.
Thank you. Great being with you.